You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and for the rest of the hour, looking at one of my favorite topics, baseball, and the science and physics of baseball. And you know, if you're a diehard baseball fan, you live and you die with statistics. The stats are people comparing one player with the other, their batting averages in different eras, you know, different the dead ball era, the home run era. They tell everything, you know, the RBIs, everything else. But have you considered your favorite player's VORP, your V-O-R-P? That's a number representing his value to a team over an easily available replacement player. How do you figure out whether that player is more valuable to your team than getting someone else? Or have you figured out the numbers involved in putting your favorite old-time player in a time machine, dropping him off with your favorite present-day team? How do you compare Babe Ruth and present-day Pujols today? How do you compare the two? How do you determine if your team is wasting its closing pitcher? You know, one of the things about baseball, you talk about, when do you bring in the closing pitcher? How much money should we spend on that closing pitcher? How do we know we're not wasting our money? My next guest says that the closer should be left in longer, something that is going against the rule of baseball today. And he has done the math. Joining me now to talk about it is Jonah Carey, editor of the book Baseball Between the Numbers. And it's got a really interesting subtitle, Why Everything You Know About the Game is Wrong. It's out in basic books and paperback. He's also a writer with Baseball Prospectus and a columnist for ESPN.com. And he joins us by phone from Durham, New Hampshire. Welcome back to the program.
How are you, Ira?
How are you?
Very good.
First thing I noticed about your book, the cover has changed.
It has changed. The hardcover had Barry Bonds on the cover, and now we have Albert Pujols on the cover. Can't go wrong either way. Both great power hitters.
That says a whole lot right there. Let's talk a bit about the numbers. What are the most abused statistics that fans like to throw around, and what statistics should they be talking about?
Well, runs batted in, RBI, is one that tends to get overemphasized, and a lot of RBI and even runs scored and some other statistics are basically what we call counting statistics. And a counting statistic, especially RBI, has a lot to do with context. So, for instance, if you bat in the middle of a terrific lineup and you have the number one, number two, and number three hitters getting on base all the time, if you are any kind of sentient human being, you're probably going to get 80, 90, even 100 RBI in that kind of lineup, even if you're not that great a player. For instance, a few years ago, there was a gentleman named Tony Bautista. He played for the Montreal Expos. The Expos had a couple of great players at the top of that lineup. Tony Bautista was a terrible baseball player, and yet he got 100 RBI that season, over 100 RBI, because he stayed healthy and because he batted in the middle of the lineup. So people overemphasizing that statistic are missing out on some other metrics which really do measure the quality of a player.
Which is the most important one?
It's tough to pin down one, but you mentioned VORP, which is VORP. That was developed by a gentleman named Keith Woolner from Baseball Prospectus. What it basically does is it has some utility. So you take a guy that you can pick up off the street, a AAA lifer, a veteran minor leaguer, someone that's readily available. Compare that person's value to the value of the player that you're looking at. So, for instance, if you talk about Albert Pujols, who is arguably the best player in baseball, if not certainly top three, he contributes something on the order of about 80 or 90 VORP a year. The simple way to do this is to take 10 VORP and make that one win. So if you're talking about 80 VORP, that means that Albert Pujols gives the St. Louis Cardinals about 8 more wins per season than the guy you would pick up off the street.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking baseball with the editor of Baseball Between the Numbers, Jonah Carey. You talk about in the book one of my most talked about statistics and or most argued about, I think, among baseball fans, and that is how long to leave a reliever in, and better yet, when do you bring the closer in? How, you know, we hear closers, we bring him in for 4 or 5 outs, it's like terrible. Mm-hmm. But you point out in your book, and this was very interesting, that during the stopper era of the 1970s, it was common to see a relief ace such as Raleigh Fingers or Goose Gossage come in as early as the 6th inning to halt a nascent rally. That was the smart way to go. Wow, why was that so smart, and why don't people still do that?
Well, the smart way to go is to use your best relief pitcher in what we call the highest leverage situation. Sometimes that can be in the 9th inning. If you come into the tie game in the 9th inning and the bases are loaded and the game's on the line, bring the guy in then, absolutely. Sometimes that situation can happen in the 6th inning or the 7th inning, though. You have to be flexible with how you use your closer. The problem is the way today's closers are being used is they come in the 9th inning in what we call a save situation. A save situation is any situation in which the team is winning by 3 runs or less, and they have a chance to save the game late in the game. So often it'll be the team's up by two or three runs, the bases are empty, and they only need to get three outs. Well, you know what, Ira? I give you a 50-50 chance of producing in that situation. That's not all that tough. But if you come in tie game, sixth inning, the game is on the line, you've got Albert Pujols at the plate, you need to strike him out to preserve the game, now that's tough. And that's the kind of situation that a Joe Nathan or a Mariano Rivera or a Billy Wagner or a really elite relief pitcher should be looking to enter. Not necessarily the robotic situation in the ninth inning, but the real key situation that can sometimes be earlier in the game.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. How do you know, how do you put a value on a player financially? You know, people keep talking about Alex Rodriguez, the highest paid player in baseball, A-Rod here in the Yankees, as being overpaid. Can you actually put a number on the statistics and see if he is or isn't?
You can to a certain extent. What we like to do is, the people at Baseball Prospectus do this. This is in the book, Baseball Between the Numbers, too. You look at what's called marginal dollars per marginal win. So all that means is you would take a statistic like a VORP or any statistic that's a little bit more advanced and see how many wins does this guy contribute on the field. So again, you have an Albert Pujols. You say he's worth, on average, about 8-9 wins a season over the guy you pick up off the street. So you establish what is the going rate in Major League Baseball for a player of that caliber. So if you say that one win is worth $2 million and two wins is worth four and so on, you would say Albert Pujols gives you eight wins. That's worth about $16 million a season. That's about the average. So the key is you don't want to overspend what everybody else does. If you're paying Pujols $30 million a year, you're probably going way over. If you're getting him for $13 or $14 million a year, you're actually getting a little bit of a bargain. So the key is find the metric that works for you and then try to match, if not better, the rate that other teams are paying their players.
1-800-989-8255. Who works better statistically? Managers who play from their hunches and their guts, or managers who are playing by using all those printouts they use now?
Like any scientist or teacher or dentist or anything else, it just depends on how intelligent the person is, Ira. I mean, if you have a manager who's really smart and he's using his gut, I like that guy's chances better than the one who maybe uses statistics but uses them incorrectly. There is no one right answer. Statistics can absolutely do it, but sometimes if you have a lot of experience around the game, you might see something that the statistics don't capture. For instance, if you take a pitch, if you're looking at a pitcher, it's the fifth inning of a game, and statistically you know that this pitcher tends to do well six, seven, eight innings at a time. But the manager who's been in the game for 40 years looks at the pitcher and says, his arm is dragging, his facial expressions aren't right, I think there's something wrong. He's either injured or tired, and he pulls the pitcher from the game. You might be saving a potentially explosive situation. The pitcher could give up five runs, tear his rotator cuff, and be out for the season if you don't take him out at that point. So
Right. You
need to have that combination of personal observation and statistical analysis to really do this right when it comes to baseball.
Mm-hmm. You have a great chapter in your book called "Is David Ortiz a Clutch Hitter?" Because we all know that, you know, when the last guy you want to face with men on base is probably David Ortiz. How do you determine whether, you know, he is a clutch hitter or not?
Well, first of all, the reason that the last guy you want to face is David Ortiz is because David Ortiz is one of the best hitters in the league. I mean, that is the key, is that for the most part, the best clutch hitters tend to be the best hitters. There's not much difference. If you look at what we would call clutch hitting, most of that has to do with just the guy being simply a good hitter. A little bit of that has to do with luck and variance, where sometimes you could have a player who normally bats 250, in one particular season he'll bat 300 with runners in scoring position or in a clutch situation. But over the long haul, when you take a player's career, this stuff tends to even out. If you talk about what we call true clutch hitting, that's maybe 2% of the equation. It's a very, very small number of players who consistently rise above. And even then, a player more likely to do it is not necessarily an Ortiz type, but rather a contact hitter who has the ability to make adjustments and knows how to dump a single the opposite way. Tony Gwynn, for instance, Mark Grace, these are players that over the course of their career hit a little bit better in what we call clutch situations than otherwise. Not home run hitters, but guys who just had great bat control and had the ability to put the bat on the ball in those situations.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Lots of people want to get in on the conversation. Let's go to Andrew in Cincinnati. Hi, Andrew.
Yeah, so you were talking about the stopper era in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people I remember from that is Raleigh Eastwick, who was on the Reds.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd be brought in when the other team had a rally of runs that needed to be stopped. And when you saw him then, you'd wonder why he was a relief pitcher and not a starter. But when they got traded after the big Reds fire sale, you know, you wondered why he didn't you found out why he wasn't played more, because he was only good for about one inning.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true, and a lot of relief pitchers are built that way. If you look at some of the greatest closers, either from the 70s, 80s, 90s, or today, a lot of them tried as starting pitchers. In fact, I would say most of them did, and failed. Goose Gossage at one point was a starting pitcher. Dennis Eckersley, arguably the greatest modern closer since we went to kind of the new formation of bullpens, he was a starter who was a so-so starter. Eric Gagne was a starter. He didn't really pan out. All these guys came up as starters and didn't work that way. So they realized, okay, we want to use this guy for an inning or two at a time and use him in that role. I just argue that one inning only, and especially with up three runs, bases empty, that's not the key situation. If you really believe that you can only use your ace relief pitcher for one inning, okay, fine. But use them in a situation that's very important, as opposed to one that's just kind of theoretical and it's what everybody else is doing.
Why are players able to play so much longer into their 40s now?
Well, it's better training. I mean, these guys are making this a 12-month-a-year profession. Back in the day, everybody had another job, because if you look in the 20s and 30s, everybody was underpaid except for Babe Ruth, pretty much. And they had to find other jobs in the offseason to support themselves. They weren't millionaires by any means, and they were pretty much working stiffs like the rest of us, except that they happened to be playing baseball. So now you have a situation, these guys make $10 million a year or more. Their livelihood rides on not only them being in shape, but I mean being healthy and producing and doing well into September and October and in the playoffs. So their livelihood rides on it. They do a better job of keeping in shape, and as a result, they're able to last not only longer in the season, but longer into their career. In some cases, as you said, well into their 40s.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. What about one of the great arguments in baseball is the leadoff batter, mm-hmm. the leadoff position. People say, you know, you need a great leadoff player to get set the table, things like that. But he only comes up once in the game at the leadoff position. And how important is that statistically? Is there really a statistical advantage to that?
Well, it's an excellent point that you're only guaranteed to lead off an inning once a game if you are the leadoff hitter. However, one thing that the leadoff hitter has over the other eight guys, he bats more often than everybody else. It seems very obvious to you and I. We're sitting here and saying, the number one hitter, of course he comes up most often. But here's the problem. Many major league teams still use old theories about how to construct a lineup. They say, this guy's fast. If he gets on base, we feel like he could steal a lot of bases. That's why we need him as a leadoff hitter. They don't put their best hitter number one. They put sometimes their fastest hitter number one. Right. And that's not always the same thing. You want to have your guy that has the highest on-base percentage bat leadoff. A great example of this is the Boston Red Sox in the 1980s. Wade Boggs was their leadoff hitter. Well, I think I might even be able to beat Wade Boggs in a foot race. But Wade Boggs was a tremendous on-base guy who would get on base about 40% of the time, and that's why those offenses of the Red Sox were so good in the 90s.
Because he gets more at-bats being in the leadoff position.
More at-bats batting in the leadoff position. If you try to mess around with your best hitter and put him number 4 or number 5 or number 6 and you think you're being cute, all you're doing is you're costing him at-bats.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Gary in Palo Alto. Hi, Gary.
Hey there, guys. It seems like the context for this conversation is, how do you win the most games? You know, when do you put your leadoff guy in? When do you bring in your relief pitcher? What impact does VoIP have? But I'm wondering as well how much owners are motivated by team valuation, which is going to have to do to fan turnout. You know, is some of this factored in by coaches or managers? You know, how are we going to play our players, and who are we going to pay and how much in order to please the fans, in order to maximize our revenue as a business?
It's a great question, Gary, and the way I would look at it is this. The tried and true way to attract the most fans and to make the most money is, get ready, win the most ball games. And if you want to find a way to win the most ball games, you have to be more efficient than the opposition. So obviously that means going out and getting the premium talent. And yes, you're going to have to spend money. But the little things, how you use a bullpen, how you position your defense, which pinch hitters you have coming off the bench, all those little things can add up to a lot. They can be the 3, 4, or 5 wins that make the difference between making the playoffs or staying home. And, of course, if you're making the playoffs, people are interested in your team, you're generating more revenue, and it goes hand in hand. So I think those goals are not at all mutually exclusive. You can win a lot of games and make money at the same time. In fact, that's the best way to do both.
You know, when a lot of people talk about records in baseball, they look at Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak, and they say that's an unbreakable record. But when I go through the record book, there are a lot, much more difficult, many more difficult records on the pitching side that no one's ever going to break. You know, and I'm thinking of one in particular, the consecutive complete game record. I think it's 27. held by Robin Roberts or somebody
yep.
like that. Who's ever going to pitch a complete game? More or less 27 of them.
How about Cy Young's 511 wins? I don't think that's going to happen either. And you're right. And it just has to do – the thing is, people like to glorify the good old days in anything, whatever you want to talk about, baseball, life, anything. And when you look at the good old days of baseball, I'm going to be a little bit politically incorrect now and say that someone like Babe Ruth was the best player against the best white players in America that the scouts happened to find. The game was not integrated. The players were not as good. They weren't as big. They weren't as strong. They weren't as fast. It just was not the same game. And when you have that situation, when you're a pitcher, certainly in the 19th century this was the case, you could mow down the lineup because they didn't have a player come up who could hit 20, 30, 40 home runs, let alone 7 or 8 guys in a lineup who could do that. So because of that situation, Christy Mathewson talked about this in his great book. It's called Pitching in a Pinch. He used to say he likes to preserve his energy for later in a game because he's going to need it in the 8th and the 9th inning. Well, if you try to preserve your energy now and Barry Bonds comes up to the plate in the 2nd inning, you are going to the showers, my friend. You cannot do that anymore.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. It's time for us to go to the showers, and then we can't wait for opening day.
Neither can I. Thanks, Ira.
I want to thank you very much, and it's a great book. This is the kind of book you want to sit down and watch the game with. It's Baseball Between the Numbers, now out and revised in paperback. Why Everything You Know About the Game is Wrong. It's put together by the Baseball Prospectus team of experts and edited by Jonah Carey. Thank you, Jonah.
Thank you.
For taking time to be with us today, and happy season to you. That's about it for this program. Our program is produced by, well, let's talk about Kimberly Jones as our technical director. Audio engineers are Neil Rausch and Josh Rogerson here in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We're blogging and podcasting. I'm listening to the music, and I want to listen to it. I'll let you listen to it. So I'll just wish you have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. They'll be with Willie, Mickey and the Duke. Willie, Mickey and the Duke. Say hey, say hey, say hey. It was Willie. Say hey, say hey, say hey. I'm talking with